Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insight and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with stories that really matter. And coming up on the program today, the new bird flu threat, the Department of Agriculture on vaccine availability. South Africa's digital well-being is the best in Africa, according to a new report. Why most of the world's airports are not using artificial intelligence. And it's called the Trump Gold Card. Is it just a money-making passport scam? It's Thursday, the 27th of February. Bird flu remains one of the biggest threats to South Africa's poultry industry, and a year after a devastating outbreak that saw millions of birds culled and then a spike in food prices, poultry farmers are once again raising alarm bells. This time their frustration is directed at the government's sluggish rollout of vaccines, their claim, which they believe could prevent another crisis. Now, despite international examples of successful vaccination programs, South Africa has yet to make these vaccines widely available, according to the South African Poultry Association. Now, with food security, jobs and the survival of the industry at stake, the question is the Department of Agriculture dragging its feet? Now, this is what the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Poultry Association, Isaac Breitenbach, told me earlier.
This is a controlled disease. We've only got two controlled diseases in the country, of which influenza is one. That means that the Department of Agriculture control the disease. We can't just blanket vaccinate. We need to apply to get permission to vaccinate. And the permission will only be given once we comply with certain biosecurity rules set out by the Department of Agriculture. And we need to do certain monitoring or sampling of bloods to ensure that we don't have the disease amongst vaccinated flocks to satisfy the Department of Agriculture. Now, the Department of Agriculture set these standards of biosecurity so high that we haven't yet got one farm that was able to comply with the stringent requirements, and that's preventing us from vaccinating.
More now from Dipepeneneng Serache, who is Deputy Director General, Plant Production and Animal Health at the Department of Agriculture. DDG, thank you very much for talking to us today. Has the department been slow in approving vaccines?
Not. We've not been slow. Thank you for having us, and so that we can set the record straight. It will help in the future to bring us and Mr. Breitenbach in one discussion chamber so that we can demystify the myth that and the misinformation that they're peddling around. This is what is happening. Avian flu, highly pathogenic avian influenza, has two strains that are known and which are dangerous, H5 and H7. As at today, there is registered vaccines for one strain, H5. That's not a problem. There is vaccine. We do not have vaccines for H7. Now, how should government be doing to try and tackle the situation? Let's start with the availability of vaccines. It's a lot of work and it requires investment. And we just don't have the vaccine in the country. In 2023, 2024, it's about 8 companies applied to register vaccines for both strains. The only strain that was found registrable and was subsequently registered was a vaccine against H5. For H7, we do not have as the country, so there is no vaccine for H7. It's not like we're dragging our feet. Secondly, we've developed what is called a protocol as early as mid last year, actually, June, July, if not before. We engaged Mr. Breitenbach and the South African Poultry Association, both from the broiler, which Breitenbach is the leader of, and from the egg, which Dr. Bahani is a leader of. We engage them throughout the process and the rest of the other industry players. The process requires us to register what you call a scheme, but we started at what you call a protocol. What is a protocol? Protocol is a procedure that anyone who wants to vaccinate their chickens, they've got to adhere to strict rules, strict processes that they have to adhere to, and this is biosecurity requirements that they need to adhere to. Mr. Bredenbach went on radio before talking to us, and he didn't even mention that he's been part, when we were developing the protocol, he's been engaged all the way. He forgets to mention that information. He now says it is too stringent, it's very difficult to comply with. We agree, but it's not impossible. The new procedure.
So let me ask you then, how are you going to refine or simplify those protocols to prevent another outbreak of bird flu?
Section 11 of the Animal Diseases Act makes it an obligation of anyone who wants to farm in animals to adhere to biosecurity measures. If all farmers were to adhere to biosecurity measures, we wouldn't have outbreaks, in simple terms. So it is the obligation of any farmer to, one, ensure that they do not get infected, and secondly, to ensure that in the event they get infected, they prevent the infection from spreading from their farm to the nearby or the neighboring farm. So the obligation is on them to ensure that they don't get infected. But as state, avian flu is what we call, falls under the category of diseases that we classify as controlled animal diseases. Controlled means we control it because we come in and we bring in measures that with which we are going to ensure that we don't only protect them or don't only enable them to farm and make profits, but we also ensure that we do not poison the citizens of this country. We make sure that we do not make the disease endemic. In other words, we don't want the South Africa to normalize the bird flu.
So am I hearing you correctly in saying then that an impasse now exists unless the poultry industry itself implements those biosecurity measures as dictated by the protocol?
Yes, it's not an impasse. I wouldn't call it an impasse because, like I mentioned earlier, that we've got relationship with all other industries, and in this specific case, the egg part of the South African Poultry Association. So we've got two, like I said. Under Dr. Balahane, the egg unit or the egg part of the Poultry Association, we are in engagement. What we're going to be doing now, as provided for by our law, is to register the protocol as a scheme. What that means is that those who want to vaccinate will come forward and raise their hands and that they want to be vaccinated, and we will start the process of registering the farm, getting it ready to receive the vaccine. By the way, this vaccine, because it's a very dangerous and we don't want anyone to handle it recklessly. It will be issued through a prescription from the registered veterinarians, and are going to ensure that each and every dose goes to where it's supposed to go, and thereafter the bays that would have been vaccinated are followed through and accounted for all the way. So those that want to vaccinate, they will register and will be allowed to vaccinate against strain H5. So that's what, in fact, at the moment, as talking to you today, those that want to vaccinate must come forward and they'll be assisted through the process of registering, the process of ensuring that they are allocated veterinarians who are going to work with them to ensure that they comply with the requirements as set out in the protocol.
Mr. Sarachi, are you not worried about timelines, though? For instance, countries like France and the Netherlands are already vaccinating, and we're not even close, it seems.
Thank you for raising that. It's a misinformation. There's no country in the world that has vaccinated chickens against highly pathogenic avian influenza. These are just lies that have been peddled around. France, the only country in Europe that has vaccinated, at least the information that the official data and records that we have, is that France has vaccinated 20 million ducks, not chickens, ducks, against a highly pathogenic avian influenza, not chickens.
All right, thank you for clearing that up. Mr. Sarachi, just one quick question in conclusion. What happens to those farmers who don't come forward and register?
they just cannot vaccinate. And if they cannot vaccinate, or if they are found to have been vaccinated, they would have contravened South African law, and they will be followed up through the processes of penal processes. No one is going to vaccinate unless they adhere to the rules. How, where else are they going to get hold of the vaccine for starters? Now, if they just go, instead of talking to us and finding ways, they go around talking to the media, let them do that. But my advice to them is, while they're enjoying their media expose, they must spend some time to come and talk to us, and so that we can find out ways in which we can assist them to work around how they can vaccinate. Lastly, they're saying, Mr. Brennerberg, I heard him on radio saying, it is just too strict, stringent, no one can comply with. Then he leaves it there. You know, Mr. Max, that in science, if you think what we put up as a requirement is impossible for you to comply with, you provide what you call equivalence. You must, the intention is to arrive at the same outcome. If you think what we set out in the protocol is difficult for you to comply with, then provide us with an equivalence assurance that you're not going to have the virus spread, not going to endanger the lives of the citizens of this country. Because so as long as you can come up with an equivalent, we'll start talking. But just saying it's impossible, it's not assisting.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. That is Dipepe Neneng Serache, who's the Deputy Director General, Plant Production and Animal Health at the Department of Agriculture. Thank you very much indeed for government's perspective.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the United States, I don't think I need to tell you, has long been a destination for those seeking what they hope would be better opportunities. But a new visa proposal from President Trump is set to change the landscape of migration. The so-called Trump Gold Card would allow wealthy individuals to secure a U.S. visa in exchange for something like $5 million. And that would give a pathway to citizenship, in other words, a green card. Supporters argue that the move will attract global investors and could boost the American economy. Critics claim, though, it's a blatant cash for passport scheme that prioritizes the rich over skilled migrants. So how does this proposal compare to existing U.S. visa programs? And I'm wondering what the broader economic and political implications are. I'm going to discuss that with the MD of Henley and Partners, Lisa Chepek. Lisa, this visa program, then, many people are saying it effectively puts American citizenship up for sale. What's your view?
This is a, you know, Henley and Partners specializes in residence and citizenship by investment. And this industry is constantly under scrutiny of some sort with regards to so-called selling of passports. However, you know, the governments do have very strict due diligence processes that they adhere to when vetting investors into their programs. So it really comes under scrutiny often because, you know, real estate is often the vehicle for investment, and real estate prices are said to be inflated as a result of investors able to purchase property. But this isn't really the truth. There's a lot of other reasons for property prices going up. But it is. I mean, Jeremy, this industry is under scrutiny all the time. But it really is, there is a solid way for investors to access a second residence or citizenship, have global mobility, and the world is becoming a smaller place, you know, and this global mobility is, you know, paramount for wealthy individuals.
A smaller place indeed, but maybe also a signal towards a shift regarding a more transactional approach to immigration.
Yes, I mean, look, this industry has been around for over 25, almost 30 years. So it has been an option for decades, so to speak. And, you know, it just helps those individuals who are born into a nationality that, you know, restricts them. It just gives them options.
The argument against it is the exclusionary aspect of the offer. It would have a negative impact, surely, on middle-class immigrants who simply can't afford a price tag of something in the region of $5 million US dollars.
Correct. I mean, these programs, Jeremy, are for wealthy, high-net-worth individuals. That is and does exclude, you know, those who can't afford it, 100% right.
It could also disproportionately, say some critics, attract foreign oligarchs and even politically exposed persons to the program. Again, it's not without its risks.
So, I mean, Henley & Partners, for example, does very strict onboarding processes before we take on any client. The politically exposed persons are not able to be onboarded by us, for example. There are companies out there, I believe, that may do so, but Henley & Partners will not take on politically exposed persons. And we have very, very strict onboarding, due diligence, background checks before taking on any investor into any program. We do turn applicants down often.
It's also important, I would imagine, that beyond that initial due diligence, safeguards are also in place to ensure that investors actually contribute to the economy rather than just, in the United States' case, securing a green card or citizenship of any other country.
Absolutely. I mean, the bottom line for all of these investment migration programs is inward investment for the country that's hosting the program. So, you know, it really is a good way for countries to generate inward investment from high net worth, vetted, clean individuals. You know, they all have to go through background checks, strict due diligence to be able to partake. And then their investment is into the economy. It's into various vehicles. So it depends on the program. It could be real estate. It could be government bonds. They all differ. But absolutely, the aim is to generate inward investment for the host country.
What do you make of that $5 million US price tag? Is citizenship worth that price, do you think?
Jeremy, we see it all the time, what clients are actually willing to pay for a second citizenship. And yes, the $5 million price tag for this proposed Trump gold visa is in line with the rest of the world. I mean, Singapore, for example, has a residency program with a price tag of 10 million Singapore dollars. New Zealand, also a residency program for 10 million New Zealand dollars. Malta sits around a million euros for their citizenship program. So yes, it's very much up there in the realms of the expensive side of the program, but it's not unreasonable.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Lisa Chepek, thank you indeed, MD of Henley & Partners. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in a world where digital access shapes everything from economic growth to political engagement, South Africa is finding itself at something of a crossroads. The country ranks first in Africa for digital well-being, that's good news, but lags far behind global leaders, coming in at 66th place. While internet affordability is a bright spot, there are concerns over internet quality, cybersecurity, and infrastructure. All of that still persists. So what does this ranking really tell us about South Africa? And despite the progress, what are we still struggling for? Unreliable connectivity, weak online security are two things that spring to mind. Well, I want to break it down for you, and I'm in conversation now with Luis Costa, research lead at the cybersecurity company Surfshark. Luis, a very warm welcome. So we rank high on this continent for digital well-being, but we're struggling globally. I guess the obvious question is, why is progress so slow?
Well, thank you so much for having me today. That's true. South Africa at the moment is lagging behind in their digital quality of life, despite being the first place in the region amongst African counterparts. This reflects a commitment to develop the digital landscape in the country and to try and position the country as a leader in leveraging these technological advancements. However, there are some things that are still lagging a little bit behind. Challenges, for example, in internet quality, which is 15% lower than global average. Although there are some positives in the sense that, for example, the fixed speed has grown by 13% and the mobile speed improved by 34%. But there's still some challenges in this particular pillar of the digital quality of life.
Luis, you talk about digital quality of life. What exactly does that mean?
Well, digital quality of life is the name that we give this research that we're doing. It essentially assesses your digital well-being, as you were mentioning before. So the tech advancements that can improve citizens' quality of life. This could mean things like faster and stable internet connections, because as we know, slow and unstable can inhibit the daily use and work efficiency, but also a good and functional infrastructure that enables people to use the internet on many daily things like banking, for example, commerce, even studying or entertainment. So this is what we mean by digital quality of life, and we assess it across different categories.
Does your research look at what is holding back infrastructure development in South Africa?
Not particularly. That's something that I really am not the most qualified person to speak to. That being said, there are some things I can highlight about South Africa in terms of infrastructure. For example, it is 15 positions up, and that's the biggest change in the pillars that we have for our research on digital quality of life. And we know that when the infrastructure is more advanced, it makes it easier for people to use their internet for daily things. We also look in this pillar about internet penetration in a given country. So in South Africa, we looked at that. It is moderate. So South Africa ranks 8th in the world, but it is one of the things that is improving overall in digital quality of life in South Africa is this particular pillar of infrastructure.
The work that you do also points to South Africa's fixed broadband speeds 15% lower than the global average. Could you put that into some sort of context for me?
Yeah, sure. So we look in this particular pillar at internet quality. As you said, it is 15% lower than global average. So we looked at internet averages for both fixed and mobile. So we are thinking, for example, to put this in context, the fastest fixed internet in the world is in Singapore, and that's 347 megabytes per second. And we are looking at an average of fixed internet in South Africa at 79. So it is a little bit lower than Singapore's. When we look at the mobile internet average in South Africa, that's 91 megabytes per second. But to compare it, for example, with the fastest mobile internet in the world, which is in the UAE, that's 430 megabytes per second. So it's still lagging a little bit behind. That being said, when we compare it to some other African countries, the fixed internet average in South Africa is remarkably faster than, for example, in Kenya. And also the mobile internet average is much faster than in Kenya, for example, by comparing it.
I'm glad you raised Kenya, because while those are two attributes that work positively in South Africa's favor, we're still lagging behind Kenya in e-security. What's the situation there, and are there lessons we can learn?
Sure. So the e-security is essentially a measure that looks at how well a country is prepared to counter cybercrime, for example, and how advanced the country's data protection laws are. As you said, South Africa at the moment is lagging a little bit behind. Kenya was on 69th place, although South Africa is on 75th, so just a little bit. Mm. It's still outperforming Nigeria, for example, which is on 76th. And this could mean it is unprepared to fight against cybercrime, but there are already some data protection laws in place. So when we look at this electronic security pillar, what it really means is about how people are safe online and how countries are, you know, ready to counter cyber crimes and their commitment to protect online privacy. And although sometimes the reasons behind these figures can be quite complex, what I can tell you is that countries can always improve their electronic security with data protection laws, but also individuals can resort to individual strategies such as using VPNs, having, for example, data leak alerts, using alternative IDs to protect themselves whilst being online.
Let me ask you a question about artificial intelligence, and readiness in that respect is obviously a growing indicator of digital progress. Do you have a sense of where South Africa stands, and maybe if you could tell us whether we are sufficiently prepared for what is inevitably an AI-driven future?
Yes, that's true. The future is AI, as they say. At the moment, we look at this particular category in the e-government pillar of our research. South Africa in particular is 5 places higher than last year, so that indicates there has been some progress. This ranking for this particular one, it's the e-government one. It looks at how advanced and digitized a country's government services are. So we know that well-developed government helps minimize bureaucracy, reduce corruption, but also increases transparency within the public sector. And it also reflects the level of this AI readiness you were talking about. We know that the highest readiness also means the country is readier to counter national cyber threats. In this particular pillar, South Africa has risen from its position last year, which means there is some progress being made in this particular one.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. That is Luis Costa, research lead at the cybersecurity company Surfshark.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Artificial intelligence is transforming industries across the world. I don't need to tell you that, from healthcare to finance. But interestingly, aviation remains one of the slower adopters of AI technology. There's a new study that reveals that while airports and airlines are increasing their IT budgets, AI remains low on the priority list. With growing passenger numbers and increasing pressure to cut costs and improve efficiency, my question is, why are more airports not investing in AI? Are outdated regulations, perhaps financial constraints or even cybersecurity concerns, holding them back? I want to talk now to Selim Buri, who is AME president of CITA, S-I-T-A, which is a multinational information technology company providing services to the air transport industry. Mr. Buri, a very warm welcome to you. So given the efficiency and I guess also security benefits, why have airports been slow to integrate AI into their operations?
Well, yes, an interesting fact indeed. AI is a lot of things. Artificial intelligence is a lot of things, but we indeed noticed in our latest report that the focus on the usage of AI is directly linked to cybersecurity. Because cybersecurity is seen globally within all airports in the world as the priority number one in terms of threats they have to manage and in terms of IT priorities. It's about 76% of the airport and the airline in the world that see cybersecurity are the priority number one. Now, there is different way of managing cybersecurity. AI is one of them, and this is the biggest part on the way it is used. Yet, AI can do much more than that. And where it's not used enough, especially in Middle East and Africa, it's definitely on the customer passenger experience and the overall optimization of the airports. So we see that the airports and airlines are conscious about that. So they are looking at it, but we are not there yet.
So it's fair to say at this point then that the industry, the aviation industry, is probably prioritizing cybersecurity, which is understandable, over AI at the expense of innovation, or is that stretching it a bit?
It's not one at the expense of the other. It's at the end of the day, you know, there is an ever-increasing budget on IT spending. This is increasing every year, and the level of spending that was done last year was actually on the higher than 2019. 2019 is always seen as the reference for aviation, so we are going above. Now there are indeed some priorities, and priority number one globally is on cybersecurity. Middle East and Africa is actually looking, the priority number one is just before cybersecurity, everything around passenger processing systems, which is something that is very important for the region. AI is there. AI is different things. It's first collecting the data, then after using this data, and then making sure that these data are transformed into actions. We are very advanced. We see a real good advancement in terms of the data collections, where we see that the work is still to be done, and it is in the plan for more of half of the actors of the industry. It's to start to use this data. So we are collecting them. We are getting ready on using them. And the industry is planning to do much more, but they are not there yet on about using this data and making concrete decisive actions based on this data. It's not a surprise because, you know, it involves many integrations. It involves making sure that all the systems are interconnected and are generated, and there is the relevant convergence of that so that we can convert that into strategic decisions. We are not there yet, but everyone is conscious about that, and I believe the industry is looking to get there within the next 2 to 3 years.
But Mr. Buri, I would imagine it's fair to say that the longer this takes, airlines and airports for that matter do stand to lose money by not implementing AI solutions a lot earlier.
I believe we are reaching a state where it's not anymore about money only. To give you a number, we will have about 22,900 new aircraft that will be delivered in the next 5 to 10 years. Almost 5,000 of them will be going to Middle East and Africa. We will never be able to build airports quickly enough or make them big enough in that time unless, so the only way for the whole industry to continue to manage that amount of traffic will be to make things differently, to make sure that their digital transformation is done using all the tools. And AI is a massive component of it. So it's much more than money. It is really about making sure that the industry will sustain the massive growth that is arriving. And after that, yes, it is money.
because when we optimize the operations, when we make sure that the aircraft turnaround is done in the quickest way, when we optimize the usage of the consumptions of the fuel, all of this will come and started. The tools are here already, so we are starting to implement, and we see that the airlines are putting number one on their priorities in terms of IT optimization for sustainability. It is all about optimizing the trajectory of the aircraft, making sure that we can monitor and manage and optimize real time based on AI and all the data, the routes of the aircraft, and the turnaround operations in the airport. So sustainability part, and this is a good news, is put at this stage as the priority number one. We are not, and I agree with you here, not using all the capability of AI to make money out of it. But hopefully this will be the next stage.
Just a final question. There will always be concern, won't there, about regulatory issues and particularly around surveillance and privacy. That's another hurdle that you're going to have to overcome.
Absolutely. This is a hurdle, and we see it extremely present because regulations are important. But regulations are not always the same depending of the regions and the countries. So this is something that the airlines and the airport, being global by nature, have to manage on the best way. We've been talking about AI, but one of the key innovations that is also about to change the whole industry is the usage of biometrics and the passengers' data. AI is one part of it, but AI is, at the end of the day, just one tool. But the passengers' biometrics and data are a key component to make sure that the safety and the processes are smooth, but indeed it comes with a lot of regulations. These are key ones. We are still, everyone is still learning on this, but this is key. And cybersecurity, AI, and number three, biometrics usage and data processing, passenger processing, are key points for the not only the revolution, but making sure the industry continue to thrive and grow.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that quick glimpse into the future of flying. That is Selim Bouri, who is Africa Middle East President of CETA, as I said earlier, a multinational information technology company, and it works within the air transport industry. Thank you very much indeed. And that's where we're going to leave it for today. This is MoneyWeb at midday. Thank you for listening, and join us again tomorrow for more reporting and analysis in 30 minutes.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.